Good evening, my name is Mark and I am an alcoholic. Hopefully you saw this box in the back of the room. On it, it says a newcomer asks. Also, there's a stack of 3x5 cards and some pencils there. What we'd like to have people do is to write down a question that they have about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. We will select the question, and then using AA-approved literature and our group of semi-experts, we will try to answer that question. We had a question submitted last week by an anonymous member. It says, why do people say someone is a functional alcoholic? How can that be when your world revolves around alcohol? Functional is defined by Webster's Dictionary as performing or able to perform a regular function or action. Alcoholic is defined as us. So, what is a functional alcoholic? What does it really mean? I'd like to answer that question because when I got into the program, my sponsor called me a highly disciplined, highly functional alcoholic. And he said, you are the worst kind because you are the last to get help. What functional means, or it meant in my case and with most of the people I've talked to, you're an alcoholic, you drink an awful lot, you drink alcoholically, but you don't screw up. You keep a job, you don't get in trouble at work, you don't get in trouble at home, you don't get arrested. You don't suffer a lot of consequences that some people do. And that might be just because you're lucky, or it might be because you are disciplined in the way you drink. You can separate your binge drinking from work in your home life. So you don't suffer a lot of consequences. What happens then, and what certainly happened in my case, is I was able to drink alcoholically for 38 years without suffering a lot of consequences. I never missed work. I didn't screw up at work. I never got arrested. Nothing really bad happened, and that allowed me to feel like I wasn't an alcoholic for an awfully long time. What happened in my case was that when I retired after 30 years of my job and took up drinking full time, then I finally had to surrender to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So a functional alcoholic is simply one that, through luck or maybe some self-discipline, continues to carry on with his life without suffering a lot of consequences of their drinking. And thank you for that question. And now it is time for our featured speaker of the evening. This is brought to you by the Valley Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The undefeated, undisputed king of speaker meetings. This event is brought to you for your sobriety pleasure. And now, let's get ready for recovery. Our speaker has been a sober member since 1977 in Riverside. She has also been a member in Alaska and Bakersfield. Her continuous service commitments have included Grapevine representative, sponsor, cook for a weekly 50-person group, and child care coordinator. Her AA motto is, suit up and show up. And now, with all the earnestness at your command, will you welcome, please, from Bakersfield, Patty D.
You come into focus that way. I am Patty. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October the 13th, 1977. My home group at this point is the Saturday Night Select Speaker Meeting in Bakersfield. I hope you're ready for some fun because I like to have fun. And I hope that my language does not offend anyone. If it does, I'll apologize now because I have little control over what falls out of my face sometimes. I was born in Fresno, raised in Clovis, so I'm a Valley girl. I'm very proud of that. Well, I was till I moved to Alaska. Then I was far more proud of coming from Alaska. I got sober in an Alano club. It had, I don't know if it had a name, because, you know, I passed it every day, and I saw the sign "We Care" on the side. Every day I passed it, every day I said, bullshit. Don't think you care. Don't think you want to care. Don't believe you, whoever you are. And it wouldn't be until maybe 6-7 years later that I crossed the threshold of the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came into AA via another 12-step program. I was in that program for 4 years, had studied the steps, done the big book, and had done a 4-step, 5-step, all the other steps. And I had, on a regular basis, would call my sponsor and commit how many drinks I was going to have that night. That seemed to work for me for a while. And I like the definition of functional alcoholic because I managed also not to get any DUIs, not because I didn't drive under the influence. I did regularly. I drove in blackouts. I committed burglaries. I committed fraud. God, there's a list. Just never got caught. I don't know whether that was luck or just plain stupid. I just don't know. But let me talk about the way I was raised. My father was a mechanic. My mother is a stenographer, which in these days is called administrative assistant. And I was raised in a church. We did a lot of camping and fishing and so forth. I had an older half-brother and 2 younger brothers. And my life was pretty simple until I turned age 13 when my little brother passed away. And that pretty well tore our family to pieces. Now, when I say that, it took me years in recovery, 8 years in recovery, to remember what had happened to me as a young person. At age 2.5, my older half-brother began to sexually abuse me. My father sexually abused me. And I tell you that simply because it's part of my story and it's a big damn piece of my story, okay? It messed with me for a very, very long time. It really contributed to me seeking relief and trying to cope with life on life's terms. I didn't have any skills that way at all. I'm going to share with you my very first drunk. I waited till I was 21. I was 2 months short of my 21st birthday. And I was married. My husband was graduating from tech school in San Angelo, Texas. And we were going to his graduation party at the NCO Club. I sat there and the waitress came by and asked what I wanted to drink. I didn't know because I had never drank before. And I said to the guy across the table, "What are you drinking?" He said, "A whiskey sour." I said, "I'll have one." And I ordered that one and I proceeded to order 13 more. Yeah, I really should have been on my face. Well, first of all, who counts the damn drinks, okay? But that was an alkie from the beginning. And a little while, you know, after you put a lot of fluid in, you have to go to the head. So I went to the bathroom, and I'm sitting there, and, you know, I feel in no pain and kind of got a stupid-ass grin on my face. And the room begins to spin, and I think to myself, there's something in my mind about not getting into that spinning stuff, but I don't know what it was. So it was feeling really good in the spinning, and I'm sure I looked very silly. And I, honest to God, had a hands-free orgasm. You can applaud anytime. That's right. And I went, "Oh, this is why my mother didn't want me to drink. This is some really good shit." Now, I spent the next 9 years trying to replicate that experience. Never happened. Had a lot of good orgasms drunk, but not hand-free. I can't believe I'm telling you this. I was just it is my story, and that's how it all started. Yeah. Well, you know, life went on. I finished college. I drank daily my last 2 years in college. Many blackouts and many men. I graduated. I finished a master's degree in marriage, family, and child counseling. Became a therapist. Isn't that exciting? Got paid for it, too. You do best what you're learning, and I was trying to learn how to cope with life. And my coping skills amounted to drinking. I had married my high school sweetheart. I had got drunk several times and gone out on him, lost that marriage, got married to the second guy, and spent the next 5 years of our 18-year relationship going out on him. It took me 8 years into recovery to understand that what I was doing with all this acting out, for lack of a better term, I was speaking one time and a guy came up to me afterwards and said, I was a whore too, and I went, excuse me. I thought, I've grown past that word. I prefer to just call it adventurous. I mean, that really brought it home, you know. And I am so, there's so many things I've received from this program, but what happened in 8 years, the first 8 years, was I got a real insight into how that sexual abuse stuff had impacted me, because all that sexual acting out had to do with control. I didn't care if you were married. In fact, I liked it better because you wouldn't bother me when I was in bed with my husband. And that was an important thing. Any of you gone out on your spouses, your partners, you know it's real important. They don't call you at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning just to talk. I was thinking of you, baby. Oh, yeah. I know. Now, I have had wives call me and ask me if I was in bed with their husband. And I was fortunate enough to be able to truthfully say, no, I'm in bed with mine. I don't know where yours is. I didn't want to say I left him several hours ago. yeah. I was a lot of fun drinking. When I finally got a good glimpse in recovery, and I was able to see the damage I had done, there was like this battlefield of broken and hurt people. I never saw myself as someone who intentionally hurt anybody else. But that clarity that comes with sobriety, it was a battlefield of people I had hurt, and I had hurt badly. You lose two marriages because of your drinking. You've hurt some people, and you've hurt them deeply. I wanted to be married the second time because I'd screwed the first one up, you know. And I wanted to be married forever that second time. I was miserable for a long time. But I'd heard in one of my meetings that you give them as much time as you drank, you give them that in sobriety. I thought it was a dumbass idea. But it bothered me. It bothered me enough for me to kind of hang on to that thought. So I, instead of just 5 years, I gave the man 13. That was a good run. You know, 18 and a half altogether. I was just sharing with Alex that I also attend our sister program in Al-Anon, and I had insisted that he go to Al-Anon, where he met his third wife. I can laugh about that today, and you know what? I kind of laughed about it then, too, because it was like, oh, baby, you think you landed the big fish. Trust me. It was a, what is it called, those carps? That wasn't very nice. It took me 10 years in sobriety to forgive him and to forgive me, and I couldn't tell who I was madder at, him or me. But once I learned how to forgive him, I could then begin to forgive the other people in my life. I think that is the, besides sobriety itself, because that's what got me through the rest of the steps and the rest of the lessons, and some that I have yet to learn, that is the biggest lesson I've learned in this program, is how to forgive others. No matter what, my job is to take care of my side of the street. I'm not interested in yours. You might piss me off, but that's not my problem. My problem is me. And so I clean me up. My thoughts, my actions, my reactions. I have learned how to respond to life rather than to react to it. Very powerful lessons. You might be wondering why I've got these papers, because I'm old and I forget. Even my own story. I remember, let me go back to that wonderful Alano Club that I walked into. There was a gentleman, and every time this time of year, I think of Jimmy. Jimmy looked like Santa Claus with a crew cut. He was a big, large man with his twinkly blue eyes and this crew cut. And every time he started his share, he would say, "Hang up your hat, you're home." And I held on to those words. I heard nothing else in meetings. I held on to that man's words. And I'm sure he is gone now, because he was probably in his 70s then. That was all I could hang on to, because I was afraid I didn't belong here, because I hadn't had DUIs, I hadn't been in jail, but it's fill in the blank. I was really afraid that you would find out I wasn't really an alcoholic, and you would ask me to leave. And I was terrified because I didn't belong anywhere else. I had this incredible loneliness that was just the core of who I was. And I had friends. I smiled, high waved, and did things. But in my core, and the 12 and 12 talks about this incredible loneliness before we got sober. And I remember reading that and going, oh, my God, I better read that again, because that was surely me. I sat in meetings for 2.5 years. I went to meetings twice a day. I never spoke to anyone. I did not have a sponsor, and I am not recommending this to any of the newcomers. It was a very painful time. I was afraid you'd ask me to leave, so God forbid you get to know me. And I sat there, and I went to 2 meetings a day, and I did it over and over and over again. And I didn't drink. That, today, I know is the grace of a great spirit who loves me unconditionally. I didn't know what it was then, because I was hanging on by my little fingernails. I also came into the program, and there were maybe 2-3 women and 60-70 men. So if you're sitting in here, it looks about half and half to me, and you're a lady, you're in a good time in AA. It was very lonely to not have a lot of other women. It was particularly rough for me, because I saw all the men as old candy in the candy shop. I remember sitting there 1 or 2, 3, 4 meetings into it, looking around going, very nice. And I heard this voice that says, your life depends on you not preying on these men. And I thought, shit, there's a lot of good looking men here. But I can do it. There's a lot of men in the world. You know, I don't have to just prey on these men. So that's how I talked myself out of that one. Yeah, a good rationalization that happens. And I never did. I've never dated anyone in AA. I have always acted with integrity ever since I got sober. I am not the whore I was when I walked through the doors. I am a lady today, regardless of my language. I am what I am, and really my favorite word is the F word. So I've really been taking care of business tonight. I didn't have a sponsor when I first got sober. I had spent the first year of sobriety, and I was really just dry, planning to hire a man to kill this other man I didn't like. I know you would just never know it from the States, would you? But I had the money, and I had, and my older half-brother was a hoodlum. He's a badass guy, he really was. Anyway, so I knew where to find someone to kill this guy. And I knew that probably wasn't a good idea for me to spend the rest of my life in jail, away from my son, my family. So I finally began to nut up, and I really was very, very crazy in the program. So I went to my friend, and I said to her, I'm crazy. She said, why don't you try doing it their way instead of yours? I thought that was a very good idea. It was probably the best idea I had to date. So I went and found a sponsor, and I began to work with her. And I did a four-step around this man and the bad things I thought he did to me. I was much meaner to him, trust me. And so we did this. I did this four-step, and I did the fifth step with her, and she said, okay, now look, you need to make amends to this guy. And I went, okay, I am willing to make the amends, but every time I think about seeing him, I want to kill him. How am I going to do this? She said, well, why don't you write him a letter? Oh, I could do that. Yeah. Because, I mean, calling him, seeing him, ooh, I just wanted to, really, I want to hurt this guy. So she said, let's just write him a simple letter. I am sorry for my past actions and behavior. I went, oh, wait. So I write this down. I thought that sounded really good. So I did. That's what I said. I said, well, now, how do I sign this? And she said, sign it, love, Patty. I went, love? I don't want to send him any love. What the hell's that about? She said to me, Patty, if you can't give him your love, give him God's love. Well, I wasn't on very good terms with God, so I said, no sweat off my back. All right, I'll give him God's love. And I said that to her. She just nodded. And I thought, now I can look back and go, what a very wise sponsor I had chosen. And I sent this letter to this man, and I got back a letter that apologized for some of his behavior and wished me well. And I was done. I didn't want to kill him anymore. I was just done. I'd used the steps and done it with a sponsor, did it the way you suggested it, and it worked, son of a gun. Was not long after that, she left the Riverside area, went up north, and she passed away from cancer. It took me 2.5 years to get a sponsor, and then she leaves and abandons me. Think of this. It's all about me. So I spent a long time without a sponsor. Went to Alaska, got there, celebrated my 4th birthday and every birthday until my 32nd. And I moved down here, retired into Bakersfield, and I went back to Riverside. I wanted to go back to that Alano Club. And so I had arrived on the 4th, and on the 12th, I drove to Riverside. They had torn the Alano Club down. I was really heartbroken. I wanted to see We Care, because now I believed it. And they tore that building down, but they had a new one. And I had arrived at a noon meeting. I had arrived maybe 5 or 10 minutes late, but I went in, slipped in, sat down. And I celebrated my 32nd birthday in the room with people I didn't know. And it was okay, because they were my family, just as surely as you are. I don't have that loneliness anymore. My heart is full of love most of the time. I get off balance once in a while. And people say, oh, you have 34 years. Yeah. Just telling Frank up here. I have to count him every time because I can't believe it's been that long. Because I live one day at a time, one minute at a time. I don't live in the future, and I don't live in the past. I had a date recently. This is really funny because it's been 21 years since I had a date, okay? So it was a big fucking deal. And my sponsor said, Patty, it's just lunch. I said, yeah, I know, but it's been 21 years. Somebody asked me to lunch. Jeez. Patty, it's just lunch. Oh, yeah, but you don't understand. It's a date. She said, it's lunch. that you're not going to take this joy away from me. No, I'm hanging on to this one. So I went to lunch, and I had a lovely time. We talked for a long time, talked on the phone several times after that. Then I went back to Alaska to work for several weeks. And I came back. Our roundup in Bakersfield was happening. I was speaking on the old times panel. I was involved in that. And I sat down next to my sponsor, and she said to me, "How's so-and-so?" I looked at her, and I said, "Who are you talking about?" She looked at me like I completely lost my mind. She said, "You know, so-and-so." "Oh, no." She said, "Your date?" "Oh, yeah." I said, "Son of a gun, I can't believe I forgot." And she's looking at me. I said, "No, I don't have early Alzheimer's. I live one day at a time. I don't need to remember that." Now, what I did remember was I had promised to call that person when I got home. You know when I called that person? A week ago, Tuesday. The good news was the voicemail was full. That was higher power doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And in the meantime, though, I had been to Alaska again. I'd been to Mississippi. I've been living life. I've been living life. And the one thing I do want to share with you, because it's really, really important, to me and to my recovery, about 14 years ago, I got up one morning and I went to work. And I was sitting at my desk about 8:30, 9 o'clock, and I began to cry. And I couldn't stop crying. And I cried, and I cried, and I cried all day. I went, "Man, what the hell's the matter with me? What is the matter with me?" Now, I've left the therapy field. I'm working in state offices, and I do other stuff now. But I know that there's something really wrong with me. So I called the employee assistance program, and I said to them, "I can't stop crying, and I want to kill myself," and I did. 20 years of sobriety. So you've got a lot of time. I want you to listen to this, because I see a lot of people go out, and I see a lot of people suicide. I told them I was suicidal, and they said, "Do you have a plan?" I said, "Yes, I have a plan." "Do you have access?" "Yes, I have access." "Let us call the psychiatrist, see if we can get you in." I said, "That would be a hell of a good idea." And she said, "Can you just hold on?" I said, "Yes, ma'am." And I just sat there, tears, blowing my nose. I closed my door. Thank God my supervisor is gone, because they don't like closed doors. And I cried and cried and cried and cried. Now, I'm one of these people who cry at Bambi. You know? I love Thumper. I can't even watch Bambi anymore. I mean, I really nut up when they, that just kills me. Anyway, the point is that I didn't cry all the time. This was something new. It was 2 days before I could see the psychiatrist. She said, "Can you hold on?" I said, "I will do my best. If I can't, I'll call you back." And I white-knuckled it till I got in to see the psychiatrist. We did the evaluation. I was put on medication. It took us a little while to find the right medication, but I've been on it for 14 years, and I've been stable. Now, before I was stable, I was suicidal and on the edge for 2.5 years. Now, why didn't I kill myself? Because I had spent hours and hours and hours sitting in AA meetings listening. I had worked these steps over and over and over again in my life. I had built insurance against the unthinkable. Now, just prior to this depression, I had seven major losses, 5 of them were deaths in 5 months. That had slingshotted me into menopause. That was a lot of fun, let me tell you. I don't recommend it for any of the men in here. And the women run. 2.5 years, suicidal every day. And the last 4 months, just at the end of this, I was sent out to investigate a suicide at one of the treatment programs. Now, I begged them not to let them send me. I begged. I told them my car wouldn't go. They rented me a car. I didn't know what I was doing. We'll train you. And they sent me out. And I saw what having this man just in their care for 36 hours did to the staff when he committed suicide. And all I could think of is, oh, my God, this is what I would do to my family if I committed suicide. This was what I would do to all those patients I worked with over all those years, that my job was to give them hope that this program worked. I would have erased that. And I was talking to God. Now, the worst part of the depression, I couldn't feel God's presence. I knew he hadn't moved, but I couldn't feel it. And I had such a powerful spiritual experience before this happened. And I was driving home, and I was talking to God, because I knew he had moved. And I said, thank you. Thank you for this experience. As horrible as it's been, thank you. And I get home, and my precious little dog, he curled up and died. Yeah. I raged at God. No more. I can't handle anymore. I'm not strong enough. It can't give me anything else to handle. Couldn't do it. And I had to pick her little body up and take her and have her behind it. This was a long time ago. But it still hurts because I loved her so much. She'd been with me most of this time to this incredible horrible black. I can't even tell you how bad depression is. I mean, I didn't see colors. I couldn't see the beautiful colors we see around us. I saw black and white. A week later, my girlfriend died from leukemia. And I said, whatever, I just didn't care anymore. A few months later, a friend of mine called and said, I've been thinking about you, what's been going on. And I told her, and she said, you need to come see me. She was a healer. And she did, in fact, give me some naturopathic stuff that, in addition to what I've been taking, helped me get off the medication. Three of the medications. I'm still on one. Now, I'm going to tell you, there'll be people in the program that tell you don't do that. And I'm going to tell you, I would not be here had I not followed God's instruction to go to a psychiatrist and get some help. If I had the clap, believe me, I'm after that penicillin. Wouldn't you be? I have heart disease and diabetes. I'm going to get some help. I'm not going to be so damn stupid. And I read in AA Comes of Age how crazy Bill W. was and how much help he needed. And I thought, thank you, God, that they wrote about this. Thank you, because now I don't have to feel guilty that I have a mental illness. Now, I'm going to stop in just a second and tell you that 8 months after I came out of this depression, they picked me to write policies and procedures at the state level for the mentally ill in Alaska. Tell me that God doesn't know what he's doing. That's how it's been. Every experience I've had in recovery has been the foundation of the next way that my higher power uses me. And it works. It works for me. The benefits of my sobriety have been, first and foremost, peace of mind. Okay? I have an incredible relationship with what I like to call the Great Spirit. My sponsorship, when I'm sponsoring people, I am out of me, and I'm hearing what I'm telling them, and I'm getting it just as much. I mean, they are such gifts to me. Service has been a very important part of my service or my recovery, especially cooking. I didn't know how to cook when they asked me if I'd cook. I mean, I fed my family. I didn't kill them, you know. But here I was cooking for 50 people every Saturday night. The most I'd ever cook for was 12. 12 people, and that was one time. And I said, all right, God, you're going to have to show me how to do this. And you're going to have to show me good, healthy food that I can give these people that are early in recovery. And that's what I did for one entire year. And what a gift. That first 6 months, you know, I'm all freaky because I don't know if I'm going to kill you and, you know, that kind of stuff. And then I kind of settled into that service. And I pretended that everyone that came in to eat was in my home. And I greeted them. So I got out of myself and I was able to connect with other people. Given my default, just Helen Frank, my girlfriend once said to me, I never knew when I'm going to see your white ass go over the fence. And I said, I don't either. Because if I get scared, I'm gone. I'm out of here. I told Alex on the way, I said, I hope there's only three people here and two of them are you and me. That's not what God had planned tonight. Continue. A worldwide family. I've been to meetings in Mexico. I've been to meetings on cruise ships. And I've met some wonderful, incredible people doing that. I have financial security today. I'm not wealthy, but I am not scared because I trust the universe. You know, I made good decisions. I was guided by people who knew about money and people who, you know, I just learned. I listened and read the newspaper or whatever. 6 years ago, I lost four family members in 6 weeks. Now, was I scared that I would get depressed again? Yeah, I was. And I went raced right back to the therapist and psychiatrist, and I said, I'm a little nervous. She said, let's put you on antidepressants. I said, I don't want to not feel this. I need to feel it. She said, the antidepressants will not keep you from feeling your feelings, but they will keep you from going to that very black place. I said, let me sign up. Because I did not want to go back there. And I took them for 3 months, and I didn't need them anymore. And I'm grateful for a psychiatrist who would listen to me and honor me and honor my program. That was very important to me. I talked about forgiveness. I just finished a book this week that was called The Devil in the in pew number 7. And I had heard her online, Dr. Phil or something. I'm sorry to even tell you I watched that. Anyway, I don't very often, but I happened to catch this woman. And I thought, I'm going to go get that book, and I did. Because I thought it had to be about sexual abuse. But it wasn't. It wasn't. But it was powerful. And she, I'm going to quote her. Her name is Rebecca Nichols Alonso. Now, day after day, I have the choice to forgive the two men who took so much from me, or I can choose to wallow in the toxic brew of bitterness. Now, that's a powerful statement. That's exactly what I chose to do with my father and my brother. And I was telling Alex today, what's been fascinating to me, ever since my mother's death, I've been working on my relationship with my mother, which was never real good. I remember telling her, my brother sexually abused me. And her response was, I mean, she didn't say anything for a long time. And then when she did, she said, your father never touched you. And I knew that instant that she knew he had, without a doubt in my mind. And I was more angry at her than I was at the men. Interestingly enough, because I expected her to protect me. And you know what I've gotten for working and doing this work since she's been gone is that she did protect me. She kept a roof over my head, and she kept food in my gut, and she did the best she could to protect me. And I blamed her for it. And I am so grateful I have that insight. I am so grateful I can forgive. And wholly from my heart. Now, I don't discount what they did. I don't discount that they took my innocence from me. But it's because of that experience, just like the mental illness, it is because of those experiences that I can sponsor women who have been through the same thing. Both of those men are dead today, and I love them. And my son has a fit. He really does. How can you talk about Grandpa that way? He did this to you. I said, honey, I have forgiven. And more beautifully, because I'm able to forgive, I don't walk around with the bitterness and ugliness and that toxicity in me. And I thank you so much for letting me come speak. And I want to thank Alex for being my shotgun tonight and riding with me. And thanks, Bill and all of you. God bless you.